And our next speaker is Ron Silberman. Ron?
Rob, sorry.
Robert. Rob.
Good afternoon. I want to begin by thanking Dan and everyone who worked on this conference, and in advance, the projection team and Monaco Film and Video for restoring Sophie Moore and Dennis James. I guess I also owe some thanks to Craig Baldwin for providing a kind of trailer and preview. For those of you who aren't from the Big Ten, you may or may not know that Minnesota, the mascot of the Gophers. I was concerned seeing those mascots that the Gopher would end up getting eaten by a snake or something, but that didn't happen. My only regret today is that my partner in crime, my colleague and collaborator and friend Matt Backholm, can't be here. He was made an offer he couldn't refuse by the Walker Arts Center and had to stay in Minneapolis for a program there. Search and Rescue is really his program. It may sound like a generic title for most of what most of you do. In this case, it actually applies to a specific program. In 2003-2004, University Film and Video at the University of Minnesota decided to get rid of its 16 collection. And that collection of 6,500 titles was going to get dumped when Minnesota Film Arts, University Film Society exhibition program, took it over as a rescue operation and stuck it in a storage locker out in Anoka, Garrison Keillor's hometown on the edge of the Twin Cities, where it has remained. But then Matt came to the rescue, if you like, and started an exhibition program. And I'm going to read you how he describes it. A pragmatic and proactive approach to fallout from the bureaucracy to the analog digital transition, one that does not wait for grants or the bureaucracy of scholarship, but takes the films directly to the public in order to generate interest in the concept of both the program and the films themselves. Years of work with 16 millimeter film archives, this is Matt's work, most importantly, the Donnell Media Center of the New York Public Library, informed my choices of material and my overall programming aesthetic, which was originally based on the Cinema 16 model and still shares that enthusiasm for diversity and juxtaposition. Since its inception, Search and Rescue has offered over 70 screenings for audiences, ranging in size from 3 to 300. We have participated in several local festivals, had findings presented by the Danish Film Institute, and effectively funded the transfer of four rare productions of special interest. Adam Sekuler, the original Minnesota Film Arts representative and collaborator, has even established a Seattle version of Search and Rescue at the Northwest Film Forum. In the specific case of Sophie Moore, which I'm going to just mention now and come back to later, in effect, it was a film that was orphaned and promises to be readopted. That is, we're in the somewhat ticklish situation of having the university surrender a film in when they were in sort of let's get rid of everything crisis mode that they didn't want to give up. And so it will be, if you like, readopted, we hope. Matt has continued to organize search and rescue programs, which have a spirit, as that text suggests, rather like this program. Surrealism, seriousness, et cetera, all put together. The original press release that he prepared suggested two slugs or mottos for the program. One was science, history, and art, meaning head-on at the intersection of intention, accident, and poetry. And the other was embrace the transitory nature of authority. As Matt started going through them, we were able to get a grant so that he could spend part of his last summer looking at films specifically about Minnesota. And what he found there and what I've been working with him in includes another wide variety of films. For example, when the film and video program was set up at the university, this library. It also included production. And in the 30s, a film was created, Minnesota Document, that was very much in the manner of the national, the Lorenz-style government documentaries, but with Minnesota's focus. A very interesting film, which ends up paying tribute to the university contribution to the state, but also involves historical elements and things. Our favorite film so far is called slip form construction. It just shows our weird taste, which is about constructing a grain elevator using slip form concrete methods. Those of you at the Hampton Inn can look down the block. And the elevator is still standing in a small town in southwestern Minnesota, and we hope to do a screening there next summer, possibly on the side of the elevator. Another film is Heavy Hammers, which is in the manner of Your Name Here, this very weird film we know nothing about, but is apparently a send-up of industrial work from the 70s. Another group that we're trying to find more of is films by Alan Downs, who some of you may know. Alan Downs worked with, taught photography and film at the university and then went to Mexico. His daughter, Layla, is a quite well-known singer. She's a woman who performs in Frida. He made avant-garde films, nature films, math films. There was a Minnesota math project, rather like the Eames Project, and we're going to, I think, be working on that. The great holy grail of my efforts is to find a decent print of the film that Alan Downs made with Jerry Liebling, the Old Men, which was on the Blackfoot Reservation. But Jerry has no good print, and apparently no one else. There were some other oddities that we've discovered, such as Moose meets Moose, that is President Malcolm Moose of the university meeting the baby moose at the zoo. And more in a representative way, many, many, many football films. Sophie Moore is a film that stood out because it does seem exceptional. It's not as you'll see it, it's not your average student film. And we actually don't know who made it, which is part of the mystery that I have to apologize for. We know next to nothing about it. We're going to have to do more research, probably going through all the university newspapers and other documents. Virtually the only thing we know about it is that it was shown in screenings from the alumni, so by the Alumni Association after World War II, even though much earlier. So we know that they were showing it to alumni gatherings, and we hope to be able to do that again, to show this film and others to alums. We know that the people in the film, there are no director's credits, but there are actor's credits, and we know that they put Sophie Moore, they listed it in their yearbook listings when they graduated. But beyond that, we have no clue, although perhaps the restored version will give up one secret. I'll have to wait and see. But it's a surprise film. I think, you know, there are many films that are, as Matt points out, location-based. That is, they come out of a specific school or a specific campus. But I think it would be quite surprising if many schools had films like this one. So I guess we're ready to look at Sophie Moore, which is definitely not for gophers only. So I hope you enjoy it. Where's the switch?
Thank you, Dennis. I don't know if we said this, but we are very happy at USC to have Dennis as a research fellow on our faculty. So, quickly, we have a few minutes for some questions, if the panelists can come to the table. Yes, Dan? Come on up, guys. Come sit at the table.
All that we found was the real.
Come to the table and the mic.
All that we found was the small reel of 16 in not very good shape. So there is a university vault in the basement of one of the administration buildings that's something like the cellar in Psycho. And we've been digging through that, but I think we'll never, I don't think we'll find any other materials from this. I should mention that is the university president, and Jennifer Horn may have noticed, her office was in that building they were going up and down the stairs of, and Charles' wife Heidi was in there too. So those buildings are still all there. That's the old part of campus.
So no record about when that 60 millimeter print that survived was made from the original.
No, we don't know anything about it. that. That, I mean, because the records from university film and video don't go back that far, and we haven't found anything.
Rob, you may want, I'm over on your left, disembodied voice. I don't know if you know Dana Polan, but he's preparing a book on early film courses at universities, and Minnesota had one of the first organized film instruction programs, and it kind of has the look and feel of maybe a class project or something like that. I don't know if you might be interested in contacting Dana. He may have some information, or maybe you just have your own intuitions about it.
Thanks. Just one comment. I'm on?
Yeah,
I guess so. Yeah, I'm over here. Just a comment. I'd like to introduce another element to your examination. I certainly cannot speak on in terms of your work in Canada or the Netherlands, but in terms of the United States, when we start looking at the 30s, in the Minnesota stuff, that was the American Council on Education funded programs. I'd like to introduce the element that these were teacher-proof materials. While we're quite interested in the technology, if you look at it in terms of social control, these films were presented to a group of well-meaning individuals who were not well-trained. And all through the 30s and 40s, there was some real tension among teachers not wanting to use this because, of course, it standardized the curriculum. And earlier, David, he didn't make reference to it in his talk, but he referred to Edgar Dale, one of the leaders in AV, who is one of the biggest numbskulls of American education. This is a man that did the Dale word lists. It was a dreadful movement of social control. So it's interesting. We're looking at these films, and in one sense, they're enhancing the curriculum, but simultaneously, they're clamping down on some very, very interesting progressive classrooms that would not use them.
Does anybody want to respond to that?
Yeah,
Charles.
Yeah, sure. Is this on? Am I speaking here? Yes, you can hear me?
Yes, you're on.
It's a pretty complicated story. I mean, I mostly focus on the 40s and 50s, but the material that I've read in the 1930s, it's true, you can see this abundant interest in trying to figure out, so what exactly will the place of film be in classrooms? And of course, they have earlier history of visual education to rely on, and you do see the sorts of things that, that David Shepherd was showing, this idea of film as an illustration. And even, I guess it was yesterday, the examples about Julian Bryan and the illustrated lecture. I mean, all these are sort of holdovers from earlier eras about visual education. But at the same time, you also have, yes, this resistance, but also experimentation with incorporation into existing class curriculum, standardization, but also ideas about discussion. And to me, this is fascinating. And so by the time you hit the post-war period, you have this split in pedagogical interest. You have those that want to pursue this idea of discussion as the proper, quote-unquote, use, and those that are promoting the continuation of the illustration. And I don't want to be taken as saying that this discussion element was necessarily as progressive as they might have described. I mean, it was a particular way of organizing an idea of a post-war liberal consensus, this idea of debate and discussion, because it was still this form of mediating ideas about cultural and educational authority. Right? It was still operating at that level as well. But I take your point. You're quite right. There were these investigations, debates. In fact, Dale's an interesting figure because he spans that period. I mean, it's about 30 years that he's incredibly active, producing documents that try to sort out exactly whatever you're going to do. And you're right. Even in the mid-50s, one of the main things that, whether it's people who are manufacturing projectors or people who are making educational films, are still encountering is what they call teacher resistance. Right, you have to break that down if you're going to have this new market soar as they hope it will, and it eventually it does. So, yeah, thank you.
In the Netherlands too.
Yes.
In the Netherlands as well, you can see that, especially the whole sound issue is very significant in that sense. I think in this institution, the NOF didn't introduce sound films until 1953, which is extremely late. And although they gave all sorts of psychological reasons of why children wouldn't be able to combine the sound and the image, I think the main reason why they waited so long, because there was resistance of teachers who felt that the teaching was being taken over by the film more if there was a voiceover commentary. And you can, I mean, they're not very explicit about that, but there's little details in how they justify themselves that suggest this.
Yeah. Chris? Is there a mic? And this should be the last one so we can eat.
I noticed under the producers there was both a Belgian institution and, of course, DEFA, which was the East German institution. So I'm wondering whether you've seen both cultural difference and ideological differences, because, of course, the DEFA films, maybe not the ones that you selected, but would have always had, you know, ideological content given the communist nature of East Germany.
Well, I don't see very much of that. I mean, the institute was started off during the Second World War, so that's during the German occupation of the Netherlands. And, there's one person in the Netherlands who's done research into that period and how it all started off. And the Dutch institute had the support of the German occupier, but they were very scrupulous in trying to, in the beginning, especially the first 10 years or so, they only distributed films that had been made by the Dutch, and they stored the films that they had to buy from the German occupier in the basement. They didn't distribute to the schools. And after the war, in the Netherlands, there was a very severe zuivering.
Cleansing.
Yeah, cleansing. So everyone who had anything to do with the occupier had to justify himself. And because of that, it seems like they have been extremely scrupulous in not taking on any films from Germany that tell you anything but that the bird reproduces this or that way. And, like, I mean, very, very, films that really don't seem to carry much of an ideological message. They were very scrupulous in that, yeah.
Okay. Thank you for a wonderful panel.